Today we're really going to get into the main point of the practice of this retreat. But Dujam Lingpa, in the text that I'm going to be referring to for this particular section, which is Essence of Clear Meaning, which is a commentary on Sharp Vajra of Conscious Awareness Tantra. In this particular text, he doesn't mention breath meditation at all. He just goes right into taking aspects of the mind as the path for achieving shamatha. And so you can think of the practice that we did yesterday, or the two practices, as preliminaries, really, to the main practice of what we're doing anyway. If you were really to settle into this approach for developing shamatha, then that doesn't mean that you would abandon breath meditation or that you have outgrown it, and because now you're working with, you know, the nature of the mind or appearances within the space of the mind. I think that everybody recognizes that in your meditation experience so far, that the real value of breath meditation. So the first real point always to keep in mind is that, especially if you're dealing with powerful emotions or mental afflictions, that remember Shanti Deva's advice when, you know, what should you do, or how should you express mental afflictions? What's the most constructive way of expressing a mental affliction? And Shanti Deva says, you know, be like a stick of wood, you know, bump on a log, don't do anything. And that really is Paul Ekman's advice also in Cultivating Emotional Balance, recognizing that there is a refractory period in which you basically only have half a mind when you are mentally afflicted or when you're under strong emotional arousal. You don't have cognitive access to your full mind because all you can know is the amount of mind that confirms your emotional arousal. You know, and that had some adaptive purpose when we were fleeing from saber-toothed tigers, I suppose. But it gets really complicated when we're living in these complex relationships within a society. So that really is good advice. Be a bump on a log. Don't express your mental afflictions. It doesn't mean ignore emotional arousal, but don't you? It's, you know, because there's an important message there. You know, you have become aroused for a reason, but you're going to be able to address that reason a lot more beneficially or constructively when you have calmed down and you have access to your full mind. So the point of that is breath meditation, again, can be extremely beneficial because I just remember when Lama Ellen, it was last year, wasn't it? When he got marooned in New Jersey and showed up a day late to the retreat. And he said something that was really powerful that I was able to apply when I got marooned at the Pisa airport a little later, you know, right after that retreat. But he said, when mental affliction arises, go someplace where mental affliction can't go. Wouldn't that be nice? You know, a safe room, you know, for like a bomb shelter, you know. So when mental affliction threatens, go someplace where mental affliction can't go. And where is that? To the body. Because the body, when you are engaging tactile sensations, that is non-conceptual experience. So if you are engaging the body as with tactile sensations, mental afflictions can't go there. So your breath meditation can be a real respite from just all of the onslaught of conceptualization, mental arousal, emotional distress, all of that. So it's really, really important as a mental health spa. And then it also can give you, as a preparation for doing these practices, it can just break that incessant flow of mental chatter. So it gives you a little space so that when you actually begin to do these practices and go back to dealing with mental appearances as the object, that it's just not a torrent. And so one of the descriptions in the nine stages of shamatha, coming from Mipham Rinpoche, I think, we're basically describing your mental experience while through the paths of shamatha as like a river. And so the first four stages are really like you're standing under a waterfall or a torrent, a mountain torrent. You know, so it's really, really helpful when we get to these practices of taking aspects of the mind of the path, that you're not taking a torrent. As, you know, the aspects of the mind aren't a torrent that you're standing under these, but that they become more of, you know, like at least channeled through a canyon, and then eventually where the metaphor that seems to me is most apt when we really get to taking aspects of the mind of the path is that, you know, they're Mipham's Rinpoche's metaphors are that it finally then the stream flows out onto the plain so that it becomes more, the velocity slows down and it just flows peacefully, then meandering stream, then finally out to the ocean. And the metaphor that occurs to me is that it then becomes like a dripping faucet. You know, you have, you know, individual drips of water where you can see discrete moments of thought. You know, they'd have a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, they arise, they abide, and they dissolve. And that's when you can really then work, you know, and see the nature of these appearances. But so very important to, you know, not disregard or think that you've outgrown breath meditation, because there are going to be, it definitely has its value and its place. And there could be periods during your practice, you know, your whole path of practice over an entire lifetime, where that's really what you focus on most, because that's what you need to do, is to try to control the torrent. And there might be times then, even within a single session, that's what you do, because you realize that you're just not quite up. There's too much energy behind the torrent of thought to actually work with constructively, so you just then turn off the faucet by going to the body, place where the torrent can't go. But the main practice that we're going to be working with are elucidated here in Sharp Vajra of Conscious Awareness Tantra, which is a 10-page text in which Padmasambhava appeared to Dujam Lingpa and outlined the entire path to liberation through eight stages in 10 pages. So this is really a pithy text. You know, it's just so concise. And then Dujam Lingpa taught that with an auto commentary. So, you know, in the root text, Padmasambhava, you could say, is the author or the speaker. Dujam Lingpa is the scribe. And then in this commentary, Dujam Lingpa taught to some of his close students. Pema Tashi was one of his students who he describes in A Clear Mirror also as being one of his best students, and actually being the, what was he called? Something like the conservator or something like that of the Dharma. You know, so he was really assembling this team, and the Dakinis were advising him who to pick for his team. That student would be really good for this. There's somebody over in this other valley that you need to go meet, you know, and he will become one of your great students, you know, on and on. So Pema Tashi is the scribe, and he actually is credited with the authorship of this, but it's Dujam Lingpa is the one who was doing the, you know, presented the commentary, and then it was just Pema Tashi who wrote it down. So that the title of that is Essence of Clear Meaning. And so, this is, you know, this is a different presentation of the path of shamatha than Dujam Lingpa or Padmasambhava presented in other settings to Dujam Lingpa. But it's really, this one just seems to be such a crystallization of other, you know, and kind of just, this is the real essence, it seems to me, of what is called settling the mind in its natural state in other settings. So here we go. We have here in all of these texts are outlined, for as a device for memorizing the text. And so in the outline heading, how individuals of inferior faculties enter the path. Hate to say it, or I guess I should say proud to say it, that's us. Or that's me anyway. Because the other two possibilities, above that, are simultaneous. If you're one of the simultaneous individuals, you basically just hear a few words of instruction, and then as if the dust is blown out of your eyes, and then you just rest, go directly to pristine awareness and rest there. So, and there are those. Well, Dujam Lingpa is pretty much an account of what I read last night of how that would happen. You basically recall all of the teachings of your past life simultaneously by looking and taking a big drink of Om Ah Hung. and that's it. So there you have, you want to know what a simultaneous individual is? There you have it. So maybe if you're one of those, or if you aspire to be one of those, you know, what it'll be like when that happens. And then middling. That even comes up. A weekly report available on my screen time. Even though it's in airplane mode. So not bad, an hour and 48 minutes a day. That's well below the average of 12 hours. It's only my phone, but most of it's monitoring my timer, meditation timer. So, enough of that, Siri. Where were we? Taking aspects of, the mind, so those of middling faculties, then basically hear the instructions and then go into retreat for 21 days. And, so you just go to a beautiful place with broad vistas, and then you just go into shamatha, basically. So the description here in this text is that whatever method of shamatha that you have used to achieve shamatha, you just do that. You go into shamatha and you rest in shamatha for 21 days. And then if you're able to do that, then you cut right through and without vipassana practice. So that's why it's so extraordinary that basically you're able to do this with just shamatha alone. You rest in shamatha for 21 days and then without additional vipassana practice, because your mind is, in past lives so tuned that you just go cut straight through into pristine awareness. And then for the inferior faculty, so if you're not one of those, then here's the rest of the path. And so the path then, so this is how individuals of inferior faculties enter the path. And then the next heading is taking aspects of the mind as the path. So this is the way that we enter the path and follow the path is taking aspects of the mind as the path. And here's the teaching. on the path. And then I've just included not the, the root text, but just Dujom Lingpo's commentary. Those of the class with inferior faculties, not having the fortune to identify primordial consciousness in that way as with middling faculties, first recognize the difference between stillness with respect to consciousness and the movement of thoughts. So this is the first step in taking aspects of the mind as the path. And by first taking the aspects of the mind as the path, finally, they are led to the absolute space of pristine awareness. So there you have it. It's very practical, incisive instruction here. You know, but there's very limited amount of instruction. So he's just giving us the kind of instruction that he could give to his disciples and then just say, go off to your cave and meditate and then come back, you know, when you have reached single-pointedness. And here I'm going to give you 5 bullet points and, you know, go off and practice. And this is all that you need. So they're very precise, very incisive instructions. But, you know, there aren't many of them. A little bit later, he begins to give us a little bit more on that. So there he just gave it to us, you know, in kind of its pithiest formulation. But now he's going to give us a little bit more. And here you have in your handout, in maybe it's, is it in the back, the chart on the four, the back page? What is called here the 4 modes of mindfulness. And I have to say that I no longer like that title, the 4 modes of mindfulness. And I'll tell you why. Well, I'll let Dujom Lingpa say why. So we have in the outline A double prime, the mindfulness of the essential nature, mindfulness of the essential nature of the path. And Dujom Lingpa begins here. According to the teachings, there are 4 types of mindfulness of the essential nature of the path. So now that's different, isn't it? There are 4 types of mindfulness of the essential nature of the path. And that's what I think we ought to be calling this. Because it's not in the, when I, you know, I have been thinking really when, and what this connotes, 4 modes of mindfulness, is that there are 4 modes of mindfulness. You achieve, you recognize these 4 modes of mindfulness and you achieve shamatha. But what this is mindfulness of the essential nature of the path. And there are 4 different types of mindfulness of the essential nature of the path. So you're mindful of the essential nature of the path in 4 different ways, which makes it sound more like the 4 applications of mindfulness, which doesn't imply that there are only 4 types of mindfulness, but it is mindfulness applied to 4 different domains. So anyway, I like that description, 4 types of mindfulness of the essential nature of the path. So what we're dealing with is the essential nature of the path. And mindfulness is going to express itself in 4 different ways as the essential nature of the path reveals itself. So here we have then, in this topic heading, mindfulness of the essential nature of the path. According to the teachings, there are 4 types of mindfulness of the essential nature of the path. The first entails distinguishing between stillness and movement. And by the power of familiarizing yourself with their different appearances, there is single-pointed mindfulness of the unification of the two. And the unification of the two here is talking about stillness and motion. Then, even while resting, whilst without strenuously observing them like before, as its natural power manifests, there is manifest mindfulness. So that's the second type of mindfulness. So first you have single-pointed mindfulness and then manifest mindfulness. When when the effort has subsided. So now it's effortless single-pointedness, and that's called manifest mindfulness. And then abiding loosely without mindfulness in a vacuous, wide-open clarity, a spacious vacuity, constitutes lying down on a bed that is devoid of mindfulness, which is the substrate. Once coarse mindfulness has subsided, resting in a luminous vacuity is called self-illuminating mindfulness, or the substrate consciousness. The former two kinds of mindfulness, single-pointed mindfulness and manifest mindfulness, directly perceive whatever creative displays arise, while during the latter two, the absence of mindfulness and self-illuminating mindfulness, apart from abiding solely in dependence upon a subtle mode of apprehension, all radiant appearances and creative displays of thoughts cease. So there is only non-conceptuality. So here this is the essential nature of the path. He's talking about, first of all, you develop single-pointed mindfulness. So this would correspond to, the single-pointed mindfulness would correspond to what? If on the 9 stages of shamatha, to be level 8 of shamatha, where you are now, you have finally achieved single-pointedness. So total absence of even the most subtle expression of laxity or excitation. So now you have unification of mind. There's just, or you could say maybe the final part of level 7, but not quite. So level 8, but there's still a little effort. And then he says the manifest mindfulness is the effortless one. So that would be level 9 then of shamatha. But the really interesting thing about this approach, rather than the 9 levels of shamatha, so interestingly, there are, in my reading of this, to get to single-pointed mindfulness, level 8, so basically all through to achieve shamatha, there are only 2 things to do, only 2 skills, really. You know, rather than all of these instructions that we've received and I've been teaching, there are only 2 things to do to achieve shamatha. First, recognize the difference between stillness and motion, and then have a unified experience of stillness and motion, the unification of the two. Because that will lead you to single-pointedness. And that's the first type of mindfulness. And then is there anything more to learn or anything more to know or do, a new skill to learn, to get to effortless? No, you just do that, but there's no effort involved. And then is there anything new to learn from manifest mindfulness to get you to substrate? No, you just keep doing the same thing, but then all of the appearances stop. And then is there anything new to do to rouse you out of substrate into substrate consciousness? No. You know, so there, it's interesting. They're only, in this approach, it's just so lean. There are only 2 things. So it really uncomplicates the issue. But it's elegant, but not easy to do, obviously. So we achieve, basically, we first of all recognize the difference between stillness and motion, then have this unification of the two, the simultaneous experience of stillness and motion. And that's what the virtue, I think, of the breath meditations that we were doing, among all of the breath meditations, you know, possible to do, those 2 really help to prepare you to develop this skill of recognizing the difference between stillness and motion and having a simultaneous experience, you know, with this neutral, simple, unelaborated object of the breath. And then we reach the absence of mindfulness, and it's interesting. So what is it that happens then when you reach this single-pointedness? What is it that leads you then to substrate? So here, this is a little elucidation from another text of Dujom Lingpa, where he's covering another angle on the same material from the enlightened view of Samantabhadra, which Alan is going to teach in this 8-week retreat coming up. If you sustain mindfulness while naturally settling your mind, without hopes, fears, craving, or attachment to meditative experiences, these experiences will vanish by themselves. Then, without mindfulness even being aware of itself, as a result of the subtlety of this mode of apprehension, you remain in a wakeful vacuity devoid of roving thoughts, which is the ethically neutral substrate. So this is really interesting because it gives you this, we're talking about the essential nature of the path, and of course the path that is being referred to here is not the big path, you know, to pristine awareness, but it's shamatha, so it's the essential nature of, you know, of the path of shamatha. And so it's very interesting that here we get Dujom Lingpa or Padmasambhava's insights into what happens after single-pointedness. So it's really a little bit ambiguous in other approaches in the 9 levels of shamatha. What happens between stage 9 and shamatha? You know, there's just this kind of undisclosed thing. And it's described, the best description of what happens, you know, what happens when you reach shamatha is the description's of pliancy that we've gone over in detail in other settings. You know, you have the mental and physical pliancy that arises. But, you know, talk about the senses imploding and all of, you know, that there's nothing going on. You know, but what is it that's actually going on? You know, what is going on there when between levels 9 and the achievement of shamatha? So here, this really outlines it very, you know, precisely what's going on. First of all, substrate. But here, so what's the difference between absence of mindfulness and deep dreamless sleep? You know, because we experience this every night. We experience substrate every night in deep dreamless sleep. You know, so probably 6 hours a day we are spending in this state of substrate. So the difference is now we are aware. So the main characteristic, as we'll go over a little bit later, I think this afternoon, of substrate is unawareness. So it's like being, you know, under a general anesthetic or being knocked unconscious. You are unaware of even the fact that you're sleeping. You know, it's just a vacuity. But now what you have is you're aware of no appearances. All there is, you know, there is awareness brought to substrate. So it's, you know, a qualitative difference. And then the question that I have, and I did ask this of Alan at Tushita, but he was in a mood where he was not answering questions very well, or not very clearly or thoroughly, and looking, just ripping apart little details, but without getting to the essence or something. There were a lot of distractions happening at this particular point. You know, and this was just a question that I wrote anonymously from the audience, and he just said, I'll be here. So the question then that I have is, when you achieve this third mode of mindfulness, of the path, does that mean then that you know that you would have achieved what is called turiya, basically in yoga traditions, of where you now have lucidity in deep dreamless sleep. And that basically, so the way that I phrased the question, I think, was, does that mean that, because, and I cited the quotation from Dujom Lingpa right, you know, at the right away, so it should have clued him that it was me asking the question. But the nature of substrate, so the ground is the unaware aspect of the ground. So substrate is the unaware aspect of the ground. And the aware aspect of the ground is Dharmadhatu. And so the unaware aspect. And so I ask then, when you achieve this absence of mindfulness, does that mean that you now have eliminated unawareness from your mental repertoire? So it seems like that to me. So anyway, it's curious. I think that would be, because, you know, he and I have had discussions about what is the real significance of this, as, you know, why did Dujom Lingpa give such importance that he would lay this out as give this amount of attention to it in these four modes, you know, and I haven't heard a good, satisfying answer. So I think that this is, you know, one of the reasons that it would be really significant development is that now there are 24 hours a day you have awareness. There is no point during the day, it would seem to me, that you are any more unaware. So now, and the experience, you can cultivate that experience in as part of your dream yoga practice. And Padmasambhava describes that in Natural Liberation in the section called Nighttime Dream Yoga, which is different than Daytime Dream Yoga. But you actually cultivate this experience of... And it, part of it depends, you know, you can cultivate this by the way that you fall asleep and the practices that you're doing as you fall asleep. And then you, because your first cycle in when you fall asleep is going to be deep dreamless sleep rather than dreaming. And so you can fall lucidly right into deep dreamless sleep. And so, you know, it's not that difficult. You can have an experience of what that's like to be awake, and it's this qualitatively different, you know, experience of being nothing, in a sense, this vacuity, except that there is awareness there. So, I mean, to experience that 24 hours a day, then, I think would be quite amazing. But enough said about that. And then there is the self-illuminating mindfulness. Once coarse mindfulness has subsided, resting in a luminous vacuity or substrate consciousness, and then from the correlations from the enlightened view of Samantabhadra, at this time there is a prominent sense of bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. And indeterminate visions of gods and demons may arise. These are expressions of the luminosity of the substrate consciousness. So this is called self-illuminating mindfulness. So it's a little, yeah, we'd go off track if we were to go deeply into some of the clues that there are about what happens to move from substrate to substrate consciousness. But so something happens to move you from substrate to substrate consciousness. But then when you're resting in substrate consciousness, basically this is your experience, non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss. And it's interesting that in the earlier description, he said that there are no appearances in substrate consciousness or substrate consciousness. All manifest appearances have vanished. But here he says there could be these visions of gods and demons. You know, he's probably talking about his own experience, you know, because he, you know, rests at a kind of a minimum in substrate consciousness, and he's always having these visions Dujom Lingpo, it seems. So taking aspects of the mind as the path is the whole program that we're going to be doing to for achieving shamatha. And then, so there are eight phases of outlined in this particular text of Sharp Vajra of Conscious Awareness Tantra. Taking aspects of the mind as the path is just the largest part, really, of phase one. And at the end of phase one, you actually do get into Vipassana practice, and you have glimpses of pristine awareness. So the phase one of eight is you have glimpses of pristine awareness, and achieve shamatha. So there are seven more phases beyond that, so we'll have to have seven more retreats, I guess. it's going to take, could be lifetimes, we'll have those. But so anyway, there's a lot to do in this phase one. But taking aspects of the mind as the path is the main part of it. So in this, taking aspects of the mind as the path, the first important point is to distinguish between stillness and motion. And here we are looking at mental activity, and here, what is the stillness? The stillness is of consciousness or awareness, and the movement is of the appearances that are arising within the space of the mind. And so when we were working yesterday to prepare ourselves with that basic skill of distinguishing stillness and motion and having a simultaneous experience of stillness and motion, the breath is a very, very simple motion compared to mental appearances. So that's why we start there. And basically, if you can get what that feels like, this is stillness, that is motion. With that simple motion, then, we're ready to jump into the arena of mental appearances, and to actually begin taking aspects of the mind as the path. And the key is to that you can't be watching the mind from inside the mind. that is going to be impossible. So what the key is that we have to actually step outside the mind, or we have to, our locus of view, or our perspective, our locus of perspective, meaning the point, our vantage point from where we are viewing, can't be from within the six primary consciousnesses of the five sense awarenesses or consciousnesses and mental consciousness. So we somehow have to have a perspective on all of this that is greater than all of this in order to experience stillness. Otherwise, we are only going to experience motion. And so Dujom Lingpa describes this as being like a herder watching his herd on a distant hillside, and like an old man at the beach, going to Good Harbor Beach and watching the kids frolic, on the edge of the water or running in. It's just a delight to watch these. And you can have this relationship with your thoughts as well. But the point is that they are not your kids, right? They're somebody else's kids. And so you can just kind of watch the whole thing go and not try to interpret what that shriek means. Did she step on something or is she going too deep or something? Somebody else is taking care of that, I'm sure. These are somebody else's kids, so I'm not identified with them. All I can have to do is just walk along the beach and go, wow, what a cute kid, and they are having so much fun. Wow, this is like the best of humanity on display at the beach. Every day you go to the beach, right? you know, no drinking, no smoking, no, you know, no fighting. You know, it's just everybody's just smiling and having a good time, it seems. I don't know. So it's something like that, a herder or, you know, watching someone else's children play. But there's this distance, a witnessing distance, that allows you to not become fused with the appearance, but you are just watching the appearance, you're observing it. So the crux of the practice is this simultaneous stillness and motion. But first of all, we have to recognize the difference between stillness and motion. And it can seem like, well, that we're already aware of motion, of appearances. Because, you know, the mind is always moving. But are we really aware of the motion? Or is it just motion? Motion is happening, but we're not really aware of it. And so one of the reasons that we may not be aware of the motion is because of, you could say, an analogy with Einstein's theory of relativity, that there is no such thing as absolute motion in the universe. There is only motion in comparison to other bodies. So you require a body, so an observational platform from which to say this body is in motion relative to this body at rest. And it just depends on where you're viewing from. You know, if you're riding an asteroid crashing towards Earth, is the Earth approaching you or are you approaching the Earth? It seems like the Earth is getting bigger, so which is it? Well, it depends on if you're viewing from the Earth or you're viewing from the asteroid, or you're viewing from someplace outside, neither the asteroid nor the Earth, but you have some point of view in the center, the sun itself. Your observatory is from the sun itself. And so then you can see, oh, all of these bodies both are in motion, actually. But this motion, this one is actually moving. Both of them are in motion relative to me here in the center of the solar system. But that one is moving also relative to the other body in motion. Something like that. So if we don't recognize motion, maybe it's because we have never set up an observatory on the sun. And so that's what we need to do. We need to go upstream, as I call it, to view the mind from outside the mind, to view from substrate consciousness. So the substrate consciousness is, you could say, is our observatory on the sun. So that we'll call the center of the solar system. So it's not the center of the universe, you know, but it, you know, where would that be? It's the center of our solar system, so it's relative. You know, it does have a position in space, just like substrate consciousness does. But from that perspective, then, you can see that all of these appearances are in motion. And so what we need to do, then, is to have an experience of stillness first. And this was something, a novel approach that Alan took. He didn't really emphasize it all that much, but the impact on me was really noticeable, you know, that I noticed this is really different and I like it. And that was that he switched the presentation because we were doing the four modes of mindfulness. And he normally in the presentations of, for instance, Natural Liberation, Dujam Lingpa's presentation of the nine stages of shamatha, that this practice of awareness would come at the very end. You know, and then you basically merge mind and space, and that is the end of your shamatha practice. You just do that until you achieve shamatha then. So that's, in that presentation of Dujom Lingpa, that's the final practice. And so in most of the times that I've heard Alan present shamatha practice, awareness of awareness comes at the end. And this time, he put it at the beginning. And I thought, that's good. That's helpful. And I like it. So that's what we're going to do also. The reason being, the point is that you have to recognize the difference between stillness and motion as the foundation of your practice. And in order to do that, you have to have the observation post on the sun. So what is, you have to first of all notice, and it's, frankly, it's easier, I think. It's to have this experience of stillness with no appearances, first of all. And then when you get really familiar with that, then you bring in the movement and see if you can maintain the stillness then after you have already become familiar with it. So that's where we're going to begin our practice, is with stillness and motion, to establish this frame of reference from which motion can be known relative to the stillness of our observation post on the sun, substrate consciousness. So I discovered a couple of new books while I was in at Tosam Ling. And one of them is, both of them really, really great. One of them by Lama Yeshe, a new book on Mahamudra, a new book by Lama Yeshe, but the teachings were in 1980, probably 1980 or something like that. But it was just issued, his really pithy teachings, and they're wonderful on Mahamudra. Another book that was just issued, again, of old teachings, but it came out this year, is a book by His Holiness on Dzogchen. And it was translated by Jeffrey Hopkins. And it's really, really interesting, and I'll have referred to that a couple of times. But His Holiness's view, in this particular text, his commentary on a poem by Mipham Rinpoche. But the title of the book is Heart of Meditation, Discovering Innermost Awareness. So this is how Jeffrey Hopkins, who I think is, his translations are a little clunky, I think, in comparison to Alan's, for instance. Maybe it's just that I'm really used to Alan's terminology at this point, and other things just seem strange in comparison. But so innermost awareness is how he is translating pristine awareness. But His Holiness says something very interesting, or one pithy line. He says, conceptions are not self-sustaining. Conceptions are not self-sustaining. They require engagement of mental consciousness to replicate. So this is cool, isn't it? That's just really just so insightful. So stop engaging with concepts. So it's almost as if we have this view of conceptual mind as being self-existent, and that I'm being assaulted by these, you know, slings and arrows of the conceptual mind. Stop it, stop it, stop it. Okay, stop it. You stop it, you know? Just stop putting them on artificial life support. Stop their replication by stop engaging with them, because they don't have any power other than to be alluring and compelling and to just say, come hither. Your awareness, just the untrained awareness just says, that's attractive or that's fearful, but I can't look away. You know, it's more political news, but wow, this is so weird. You know, we just can't look away. So what we're training ourselves to do is just to recognize that the participation of the whole system, you could say, in perpetuating the motion of the conceptual mind. And remember what the definition of samsara is. The samsara depends on conceptual elaboration. So is samsara self-replicating then? You know, think of the implication there. You know, does that require our participation as well? Not just by the accident of our the karma or the, you know, our karma that propelled us into samsara. Now I'm stuck here, damn it, for how long? How many lifetimes before I get out of samsara? You know, we can have that attitude. But no, it takes our participation moment to moment to moment to maintain this self-replicating samsara. Interesting. Thank you, Your Holiness, for, you know, and it's this book is just really filled with pithy observations from, again, the early 1980s, I think it was. So Alan talked about in this last year's retreat, in this approach, the four modes of mindfulness, and really it's not really the four modes of mindfulness, it's stillness and motion, that we can think of a sliding scale. And so the sliding scale, or a continuum, would be our interest in appearances that are arising. And so on one end of the continuum, you have awareness of awareness. And on the other end, you have a total engagement or a full engagement with appearances. And so I think of, he didn't quite phrase it like this, but I think of this end of the scale then would be vipassana. Because not only are you really engaged with the appearance, but you're engaged with trying to fathom its nature. You know, so this is, you know, total engagement with appearances. So there, you know, this continuum. And so we are going to work with this end of the continuum then, which is no interest in appearances. And so how do you cultivate this stillness then, in which you are not taking interest in motion at all? Because what we're interested in is really familiarizing ourselves first with the stillness, so that we can know motion from the point of view of stillness. And so, again, in Alan's evolution of teaching this, he says that it used to be, so you've all heard this phrase, invert awareness on itself. So this is the way that he used to describe awareness of awareness. When we were oscillating awareness, for instance, he would say, then you invert awareness on itself. But remember that this is shamatha without a sign, this practice. And what that connotes, and he realized this and pointed it out to us, was that that really connotes that awareness becomes the object of awareness. And that leads to some problems that lead to really, you know, some logical gymnastics to try to reconcile. But so he says now, just forget that. It's not really that. But it's just that awareness is not taking interest in appearances. So it is not extending itself to appearances. It is not engaging appearances. So it is not putting these non-self-replicating concepts on artificial life support. So what happens to these concepts arise, and your still awareness does not engage with them, and so these non-self-replicating concepts, what happens to them? Then you can really see this metaphor of them being like bubbles really is apt. The bubble just kind of rises to the surface and it bursts, rather than being, you know, a bubble becoming a jelly bean or something. You know, ooh, a bubble. A chocolate bubble, a bubblegum bubble, you know, whatever. Ooh, lick it, you know, and then memories come up about, oh, this is, I know this is my favorite flavor. I remember that I used to spend all of my allowance on this flavor, and, you know, on and on, right? The bubble becomes a jelly bean or a Jolly Rancher or whatever the... What?
A jawbreaker,
yeah. really, that's a good one. Yeah, the bubble becomes a jawbreaker. So, you know, instead of that, if you remain on this end of the sliding scale and you don't engage conceptual appearances as they arise, thoughts, mental images, all of that, memories, fantasies, what happens? They just burst. So this is the approach that we're going to take. Remain on that end of the sliding scale with just no interest. So how is it that you say, I'm going to take no interest in you appearances? What do you think from what we've said so far, going back to yesterday, to the breakout session yesterday afternoon? What would compel has the power to compel these iron filings of conceptual? Yeah, so basically what you are doing is, it seems to me, establishing your point on the continuum. Where am I going to be looking from with intention? So you really establish that. I am going to take no interest in these appearances that arise. And then you just let your intention, you know, set you there. And then your introspection is going to tell you whether you are still viewing from that point or not, or whether your awareness has been set in motion. So again, intention and introspection are very important here. And then Yangtang Rinpoche, one of Alan's main Dzogchen teachers, who Mary Kay had the great opportunity to have one of his final and sounds like greatest teachings of all time that Alan translated in Sikkim 3 years ago, probably already, right? Something like that. But Alan refers to that teaching a lot. And so Yangtang Rinpoche, Alan says that there was a point, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, witness, that Alan says that there was a Yangtang Rinpoche was teaching shamatha without a sign, and that one of his instructions was to note every appearance in the instant that it arises, and not to let any appearance arise without noting it. And so Alan just said that he wanted to make sure and clarify this point. So are we talking about shamatha without a sign or shamatha with a sign? And Yangtang Rinpoche said, this is shamatha without a sign. So you note the appearances as soon as they arise. So you take just enough, you're on the sliding scale, your intention nudges back just a little bit towards interest in appearances, just enough to note them. And what do you note them as then? As motion. Here is the movement of mental appearances, but you take no interest in what they are, who they are, you know, the flavor of it, the memory of it, the taste of it, all of that is just totally irrelevant. But the point of noting them is that if you are totally unaware of appearances and take no note of them, then these are the ones that can come up behind you with the chloroform rag and Shanghai you, right? And throw you in the trunk and take you away, and then 10 minutes later you wake up at Boston Red Sox spring training. You know, how did I get here? You know, you wonder. And the chloroform rag, because you took no note of the name Kimbrel. You know, and that is whatever, you know. So you take just enough note of them so that, and then what happens is that you don't engage with them. You recognize motion. And because you haven't engaged with them, you don't put them on artificial life support, these concepts don't have the power to replicate themselves moment to moment to moment, and to Shanghai you, so your awareness remains still. And another metaphor, so that, oh, and then the point is, I think Yangtang Rinpoche used this metaphor also in his text that he wrote. And that is that it's the noting is like simply, as he put it, like you're saying, Alexa, turn on the porch light. I hear something on the porch. Alexa, turn on the porch light. So it's as if a thief is trying to break in the front door, and all you do is, you know, turn the porch light on to let the thief know that he's been seen, and then the thief withdraws. So it's like that. You just take note that, oh, I heard glass break in the back room. And, you know, you turn on the light and the thief withdraws, something like that. And another metaphor that is common with this practice of shamatha without a sign is that the metaphor of a duel between an archer and a swordsman or a fencer. And so in this metaphor, you have an archer who is shooting arrows at you, and the fencer with a foil is just on guard, and you see the whole thing unfolding before you, but you're not just, you know, doing a windmill or something, you know, with your foil. You're just patiently and in stillness waiting, and when the arrow gets right to the point in front of your nose, you just flick it. You know, so that you take that approach with appearances. They arise and then you just flick them. But there's a little more, it seems, a little more effort involved with that. And I think that's something that you might happen after a thought has formed more. And you feel like, oh, here comes that arrow of that familiar thought again. And then you just flick the familiar thought away. But in the noting aspect of it, it seems like it is more like the perturbation in the field. You know, you just notice a few ripples and it doesn't even fully form, and then the bubble bursts, something like that. So just one last comment before we take a break. The important thing is to note these appearances as in the instant they arise. So most of our experience with our mind is that we never see the full life cycle of a mental appearance. So the full life cycle, when we are resting lucidly, watching mental appearances as they arise, in the moment they arise, watch and then be present with them while they're here, and then you watch them dissolve again. So most times we don't ever experience the full life cycle of a mental appearance. We become aware of it only after it is present. And then it is present, and then what happens? We engage with it. We grasp onto it. And so we usually don't ever see it arise, and we never see it dissolve. We just know that it's present, we grasp onto it, and then we go wandering with it. And then that thought leads to another in a chain of unconscious association that, you know, and there can be a very tenuous connection between the two elements of a chain of association, so that they, you know, sometimes it's just an emotional tone that is the only thing. The content is entirely different, but there's just an emotional tone that is the touch between the associations. So it's very important to note them in the instant that they arise and see the full life cycle of a mental appearance. And so how do you do that? Alan had this really charming description of it with describing the game that he used to play with his stepdaughter called Froggy. I think that was it. Frogger. She played it.
No.
Oh.
I just remembered the story.
Oh, yeah, good. So Frogger, you know, is one of these early video games that didn't have the kind of storylines that they have now. And so the whole goal was to get Frogger across the road. And there's traffic coming in both directions. And so, and basically you either, you know, get squished on the road and or you make it to the other side. And so the degree of difficulty he describes is that, you know, you don't see very far. The screen is small and you don't see the trucks coming from two blocks away, you know, so you can prepare. Okay, Froggy, time to get going. And so that, and then there can be either, you know, depends on the time of day that you're crossing the road, also rush hour or at night. And so the way that you could really get Froggy across the road is to, first of all, have a larger screen so that you can see the traffic coming from a greater distance and be prepared for it, or, you know, not engage it. And you also have less traffic. So you cross at 4 a.m. or 3 a.m. rather than 2 o'clock or something. So this is the, you know, the metaphor is, this is also really valuable for trying to maintain the stillness and recognize appearances in the instant that they arise. And that is that you have a more spacious screen. Your view of the stillness of your space is vast. And so any movement that arises within the stillness of space is instantly recognizable as motion. So rather than your mind being, because, and this is what happens when we engage with appearances, the vastness of space collapses to the size of the appearance. And it's like space shrink wraps the appearance, and we lose all of the context of this appearance arising within space. There is just appearance, and we become, then awareness becomes fused with it, shrink wrapped, you know, so there's this identity with the appearance. So we maintain the spaciousness, the vastness, and see these appearances arising within the space, and then simply less traffic also. So rather than a torrent where you can't even distinguish individual thoughts, you know, almost it's like, wow, you, fire hose, you know, trying to drink from a fire hose. But you, you know, you get to the point of the dripping faucet, you know, just less traffic. So, oh, there is a, within stillness, here is an instance of movement. And then you can more easily recognize it. Okay, so let's take a break, and we'll just come back at 10:20, and we'll do that meditation. And that the meditation will be stillness of awareness, or awareness of awareness.